Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Thank you very much for this chance to say a few words about J. Herbert Holloman, for whom this symposium is named. Let's deal with this name first. If J. Herbert Holloman sounds like a mouthful, Herb thought so too. So he changed his name. His given first name was John, and at a certain point in his early adulthood, he reinvented himself and became Herb. Just about everyone called him that from then on, including his children, for about half the time. So I think you can see from that alone that he was a straightforward, direct, and honest guy. I met Herb just about at this point in the year, in 1974, and I was close to him until his death in May 1985. During those exactly 11 years, when I worked both for and with Herb, we did a lot of things. Wrote many papers together, taught courses together, testified more than once in Congress when Herb was in a wheelchair. We vacationed with families. We played games, we talked endlessly, and we ate and drank very well. In retrospect, the tempo of those years seems close to ceaseless, and it was certainly intense. It has made me wonder what to say to a gathering, what to say about Herb to a gathering that may be dedicated to peaceful meditation. So I've decided to tell you two sorts of things. First, how Herb Holloman's hyperactive side has changed your lives, even though you may not know it. And second, to explain how Herb's mellow side might give you some avenues to change your lives further, even as soon as tonight. Herb Holloman, as you see by the bio attached, was nurtured at MIT continuously from his freshman year to his PhD. Long afterwards, he used to say that the best thing he did in his undergraduate years was to help abolish MIT football. And that is a legacy that haunts this place to this day. PhD work in metallurgy led Herb to write a textbook, one that I understand is sometimes still quoted around here. During the 1950s, at the General Electric Company, Herb oversaw and encouraged what some call a golden age of U.S. innovation. If you've used a Xerox machine, or if you've appreciated a synthetic diamond, then you have experienced some of the innovations that Herb mentored. Or if you've read any of Kurt Vonnegut's work about that time and place, work that, by the way, was inspired by Bernie Vonnegut, Kurt's brother, who was the official GE historian and a good pal of Herb's, if you've read that work, then you've come across a couple of characters that were consciously modeled on Herb's hyperachieving side. In GE days, Herb was a registered Republican and a corporate person, things he eagerly left behind when he joined the Kennedy administration as the first Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Science and Technology. What was this job? The way Herb liked to think of it was as an attempt to right the balance between military and civilian technology development, which at that point during the Cold War was so lopsided. He thus became a ceaseless crusader for the civilian side, arguing for more public R&D, better patent laws, a revised tax system, and, curiously enough for the time, a strong environmental and safety regulatory presence. The reason for this was that at that time, most such legislation was passed under the authority of the Commerce Power, and therefore its implementation was assigned to the Commerce Department. So one task that fell to Herb was to determine whether Rachel Carson, who we now see as the mother of the environmental movement, was scientifically right about her in her book, The Silent Spring. Herb and his committee said she was, and so DDT was then banned. Similarly, Herb and Ralph Nader, whom you certainly have heard of, became strange bedfellows, one attacking from inside the government and the other from the outside, to design the automobile safety regulatory system that we now have. During this period, Herb gave a speech proposing the creation of a National Academy of Engineering, and its support has been an important underpinning of this very symposium series. When Herb came back to MIT in the early 70s to start a policy research center, he ceaselessly accosted people with the need to incorporate the discussion of values in the process of technological change. Scott Paradise, who was then the chaplain and pioneer of this technology and culture forum, was a usually willing target for Herb's enthusiasm. At the end of his life, terribly weakened by a stroke that had put him in a wheelchair, Herb was still asking these same questions. Well, if this was Herb's hyper mode, what can we say about the mellow side? Herb's downtimes were not downtimes in the conventional sense. He was infamous for his 5:30 visits to staff offices when he would barely knock, always occupy the nearest chair, put his feet up on your desk, and demand, "What have you learned today?" After a while, those of us who were the targets of these episodes learned that it mattered very little what you had learned that day, so long as you proposed something interesting to talk about, and that it extended you beyond the routine of that day. As you may gather, Herb was an extemporizer, a person who gloried in spontaneous good talk, as he put it, and I think he preferred it even to the written word. While the details of these talks cannot be remembered, I think that all who experience them remember the sense of these occasions as profoundly rejuvenating, times when Herb Holloman pressed us, and not all that gently, to get ourselves to question assumptions and look toward new possibilities. Herb also offered living proof that good talk became better with quantities of good food and good wine. He insisted on describing himself not as a gourmet, but as a gourmand. I am sure that he would have liked the way this meeting has been constructed. He would have earnestly plunged into the substance of it, generating more questions than we would have time for. And he certainly would have appreciated the chance to continue it over food and drink. I urge you all to do likewise. Question your assumptions, maybe change your life a little bit, and make a quiet toast to her. Thank you.
Thank you, George. So this evening, we'll be spending the next hour plus here together listening to Jon Kabat-Zinn and Tenzin and having the chance to ask some questions of both of them. And then, as George reminded us, the conversation will continue at about 7:15 or so. We'll move from here upstairs for a sort of working reception. And we encourage you to stick around for that reception and have some refreshments and continue to ask questions of one another and of our speakers and our moderator, and consider that part of the learning this evening. Two final reminders before we get started. The first is that we may have some people coming in late, so if there's room in your row, if you could kind of scooch in a little bit so that people can just come down the stairs who are latecomers, that would be really helpful. And second, if you haven't turned off your cell phone, just a reminder to do that now in the spirit of the Ceaseless Society. And now it's my great pleasure to hand this program over to our moderator for this evening. And our moderator is Lee Moore, who is a rabbinical student at Hebrew College and brings to this discussion great wisdom and interest in Sabbath practices. And Lee will be sort of framing our conversation and then introducing the speakers and moderating the question and answer period. So please welcome Lee Moore.
Thanks, Annie. So we've come here tonight to stop, or at least to consider why we don't stop. What are the implications of our society, which is ceaseless, which just goes on and on and on? What happens to us when we don't stop? What happens to our planet? What happens to our communities? So, I don't need to quote to you statistics about what happens to yourself when you don't stop, because you know that, right? If you don't get rest, you know what happens to your own body and your ability to actually perform or do the things that you like to do. But as much as we know this intellectually, it's nevertheless is really difficult for us to actually sort of force ourselves to take a break. So I've actually heard a rumor that a group of MIT students and faculty have gotten together and are claiming to have invented the 7-day work week. And the patents are forthcoming. I want to offer that as much as it seems that this inability to stop may be, you know, a modern kind of problem that we're dealing with, and it's true that as we have these technological devices, which, you know, these time-saving devices, which as we use them more and more, somehow we have less and less time. It's a fascinating paradox that perhaps we'll be able to get into tonight. I want to suggest that as much as we're full of this with our technology, that this is not just a modern problem, but that it actually has ancient roots, and perhaps just has roots in our human condition. And one way that I know this, just from my studies, is that if you open up an ancient text, like the Bible, you'll see inside of this ancient text that one of the primary focuses, one of the primary imperatives is once a week, take a break. This is a practice known as the Sabbath. So, in fact, this practice is so crucial and so important, or was, you know, back a few thousand years ago, that it made its way into the primary tenets of the Abrahamic religions. So it's kind of amazing if you think about it, that what we know as the Ten Commandments, right? Don't kill. Don't steal. Take a break. That this is something that actually has come to be, have such an importance that it's included in some of these very basic ideas around behavior and what's going to help us get through as communities. So tonight, we're very fortunate to have somebody here who has been telling us for years now to stop, or at least to slow down a little bit. Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn is the founding director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. His research is in the field of mind-body medicine, with a focus on the performance effects of mindfulness meditation training on people experiencing severe stress, perhaps like some of us. His best-selling books include Full Catastrophe Living, Wherever You Go, There You Are, and Coming to Our Senses. After we hear from Dr. Kabat-Zinn, then we'll be able to hear some responses from MIT's own Tenzin Priyadarshi. The Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi is a monastic serving as the Buddhist chaplain and visiting scholar at MIT. Venerable Priyadarshi was born in Vaishali, India. He entered monastery at the age of 10 in Rajgir near the ancient Nalanda University. He trained in India and Nepal in Indo-Tibetan and Japanese Buddhism, and he was ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He received training in Sanskrit texts in Saranath, Calcutta, and in Delhi. And he completed his graduate work in comparative religion and philosophy of religion at the Harvard Divinity School. Venerable Priyadarshi is also an adjunct faculty at the Namgyal Monastery Institute of Buddhist Studies, which is the North American seat of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and that's in Ithaca, New York. So, as Amy was saying, after we hear from our speakers, we will continue the conversation, both through question and answer here, as well as in the reception. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Kabat-Zinn.
It's a delight to be here, and the title of this talk was given to me, so I just put it on my PowerPoint slide. But so don't take the Ceaseless Society too personally. It can be understood, I guess, in a whole lot of different ways. I did not know Dr. Holland, because I left MIT in 1971, and I guess he just came back in 71, he came in 72. So, but he sounds like the kind of guy I would have liked to have known when I was here. And it's a pleasure for me to be back, actually, at MIT, which I left a long time ago. And I trained with Salvador Luria in the biology department, molecular biology, here, and was very involved, because that was the 60s, very involved in all sorts of issues that went on campus those days around the nature of science in relationship to culture and society and technology and is interfacing with human values and so forth. And I don't need to tell you that that was a very, very fomentive and extremely creative and also divisive time that polarized a lot of people on campus, but also woke us up in a way that I think was really in the long run quite valuable. And I got to meet really an enormous number of extraordinary people here on the faculty and students, and it's just one of the happiest periods of my life looking back on it, and also no question about it, one of the most creative, because I feel like the culture here at MIT really does from the get-go encourage us to question our assumptions, and that is obviously extremely important in science, because it's so easy, as we all know, to bias ourselves with how we want things to turn out. And the power of the mind to create self-delusion is enormous. And scientists have to guard against it 24/7. Therefore, in some ways, they make the best meditation students, because what people don't really understand about meditation, which is a long way, you might say, from molecular biology, but somehow my career unfolded in a kind of very unusual fashion. Although it actually, the seeds of it started at MIT, and so I wound up studying the effects of meditation training, as you heard, on people with a whole range of chronic health-related conditions and diseases associated with stress, pain, and various kinds of illness, and doing research on it and the effects of the what we now call the mind-body connection, in terms of not only driving disease processes from the way we live and lifestyle, but the potential to actually reorient ourselves in relationship to both mind and body, heart, soul, spirit, whatever you want to call those deeper, more difficult ways to describe the actuality of what it means to be fully human beyond the intellect and beyond the physical body and our emotional comport. And we've seen a science grow out of this in the past 25 years, so that even here at MIT now, the Dalai Lama, we held a conference called Investigating the Mind back in 2003 over at Kresge, with the Mind and Life Institute in collaboration with the Broad Institute, and the Dalai Lama was here in conversation with neuroscientists and psychologists, Western scientists, on the whole question of how to investigate the human mind. So in the time frame that I have here, I'm kind of reluctant. First of all, I can't see any of you beyond the first few rows because I'm being blinded, but now I can see you, and it's nice that you're here, and I'll feel you if I can't see you. And I guess that's because the things are being videoed. So in the time frame that I have, which is about half of what I was sort of thought that I was going to have, I'd rather not subject you to one more PowerPoint presentation, no matter how fantastic, but rather actually be in more of a kind of conversational, interactive mode with you and just see how that develops. Because when we're talking about society, whether we want to call it ceaseless or not, this is not an invitation to to sort of cerebrize and intellectualize about what's going on in our society. This really has to do with us, ourselves. And as you pointed out, we all know what it does to the body and what it does to the mind and what it does to the spirit when we run ourselves ragged in what you might call the doing mode. When we just ceaselessly doing, driving for some kind of particular outcome that by the time we get it is no longer what we're after anymore, and so we're continually moving on to the next thing, no matter how wonderful the result was that we finally got. And so there's a sense of perpetual, in some sense, dissatisfaction or groping or striving for some kind of result that will be satisfactory, and often the process gets lost in the process. So there's some value, not necessarily in stopping, but in a sense, to opening to the actuality of our experience while we're having it. Because when you come right down to it, if we're continually living for the future, then we might miss the most precious aspects of our lives, because our lives only unfold here and now, only unfold in the present moment. So if the present moment is always a clever way to get someplace else, then we're actually, when you start to look at it carefully, never where we actually are, because we're always in some way caught up in our heads or in our dreams or in something or other that, worthy as they may be, and transformative and healing as they may be, always have one element of sort of busyness or preoccupation or agitation of mind, or a certain price that you pay for that in terms of losing touch with other aspects of our being, which often includes our children or our partners or our bodies, because who's got time for the body? And in the process, maybe generating huge amounts of suffering without any awareness that we're actually collaborating in that process. And then we just blame it on, oh, the ceaseless society, or, you know, or MIT's culture, or whatever it happens to be, where things are just the digital age, where things are just so sped up that, you know. I mean, I can think back very easily, and I'm sure the older ones of you can, to the days when, you know, before personal computing and personal computers. And, you know, with the advent of the personal computer and the laptop, I mean, it was obvious. I could get more work done and better work in a day than I could get done in a month. In many, many ways, it was unbelievably convenient. But it's also, maybe you've noticed, unbelievably seductive. It's unbelievably seductive. So the digital revolution, which you could say was inevitable because it's the way electrons function and the way matter functions, and sooner or later, clever people, even if it wasn't at MIT and Stanford, were going to figure out how to make it run in integrated circuits in ways that would, in some way or other, allow us to interface with the world in interesting fashion. So you could say it was inevitable, and we don't have to blame MIT and Stanford for it. But you know, one of the interesting things that you can pay attention to is how the digital revolution has changed our relationship to work. So that, for instance, there used to be what was quaintly called a work day. And there used to be what was quaintly called a work week. Now, unless you take really stringent, disciplined interior measures, the work, in quotation marks, can just consume everything. Because you can work, as they say, anywhere, 24/7. And there are advertisements, full-page advertisements in the New York Times and every place else. You know, extolling the virtues of 24/7 connectivity. And there are tremendous virtues to 24/7 connectivity. But you know, it may be that we are so connected, I forgot to shut mine off, we are so connected, but nobody ever calls me because I don't give people the number, but we are so connected with the world that we don't even think. It never occurs to us that we may actually be slightly disconnected from ourselves. And we no longer know how to tune in. We may have to sort of pay Verizon to call ourselves up and say, "Hello, John, are you still here?" And if I'm living in my head all the time, I may not be actually fully here. Because I'm always on the way to someplace else. There's some better something, some better outcome, some better gathering, some better place, some better condition of my body. So there's a way in which we can get entrained into the rhythms of the society, almost as if we are, and we are, when you come right down to it, guinea pigs in an uncontrolled experiment run wild. Because no one's really minding the store. And so this digital revolution, which has hardly begun to reach the real exponential possibilities that it has inherent in it, but still following Moore's law, we have no idea that the effects of this on our biology, which is, after all, millions of years old. And the digital revolutions are, 15 years old for most of us, 20, 30 years old for MIT people. We have no idea what this does even to attention. Have you ever noticed that you sometimes lose track of what you're actually doing because you're speeding along so fast? You kind of what am I supposed to be doing here? Or maybe multitasking so effectively that you've got so many balls in the air that they're hard to keep track of, actually. Why are we doing this? I love it when people would come in and into the lab and say, "What are you doing?" And you'd have to say, "Lurie, you did this all the time." And he said, "Why are you doing that?" Well, it's a really good question. Sometimes we get so into our assumptions and into the sort of momentum of what we're doing that we stop remembering, every day, maybe it would be a good idea to ask, "Why am I doing this rather than something else today?" Because while in an institution like this, we know the power of thought, there are other aspects of the human repertoire, if you will, or human faculties that are equally powerful. But they're not taught anywhere, never mind at MIT. They're not taught in our educational system. Much of scientific creativity doesn't actually come exclusively out of thought. And if we start with measurement, for instance, what is it that we measure? Because measure is so fundamental to science. We measure things, and we understand relationships. But how do we know what to measure? Well, we have to sense them. We have instruments. And instruments sense the outer world or the inner world, whatever it is that we want to study. So we have all these instruments that are actually extensions of the five senses. Actually, they're more than five senses. But one of my dilemmas here tonight is, given the amount of time, I won't have the opportunity to weave all of these threads together, so I'm going to leave a lot of loose ends hanging and just say that I tried to put them all in a book, and the book wound up being 650 pages, and it is quite coherent and comprehensive, but very, very relevant to science and culture and technology, because actually it's all coming out of the human mind. And one of the interesting characteristics of the human mind, well, we call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens. That's what we name our species, which means basically in Latin, it's the present participle of the verb sapere, to taste. Okay, again, sense, or to know. And the Buddhists often speak about this knowing quality of mind that's not thought-based, but more intuitive-based, more direct apprehension through the senses, through kind of experience as knowing, or what we could call awareness. Of course, it interfaces with thought, but it's another faculty, the faculty of direct perception, awareness, and knowing. So we're the species that knows and knows that it knows, a double dose, Homo sapiens sapiens. awareness and meta-awareness. Wouldn't that be nice? I don't think so. This is one of, I think, the great tragedies of our species so far, is that so much beauty, science, art, music, poetry, comes out of the human mind. You know, and so much mayhem comes out of the same human mind, same human heart. In a sense, because it, in some sense, we don't know how to run the apparatus that we've been given. And sometimes it takes over, and it, on good days, just blinds us, and we sort of make mistakes. On bad days, it blinds us to other people's pain, and we can create an enormous amount of pain in the world out of our own pain, and out of our own ignorance, and out of our own ambitious greediness, I guess I'd call it, to want things to be different so that I will feel better. And usually that happens at the expense of other people, because when you really come right down to it, if we're not careful, we wind up with the kind of conceit that we are the center of the universe. It's part of the, it's an occupational hazard of being packaged in a body. That the whole universe is outside, and you're obviously the center of it. And you relate to it through all your senses, including potentially this capacity for knowing, for awarenessing, if you want to coin a term as a present participle, awarenessing. That, to me, is kind of a working definition of meditation. What is meditation? It's not necessarily stopping in the kind of usual way that we would think of stopping. Stopping's good, and of course, we're all going to be stopped. Sooner or later, the ultimate stop. Some people don't necessarily think it's the ultimate stop, but that's, we're not going to go there tonight. Okay? We work a lot with medical patients who have tremendous suffering. Our track record with the dead is not so good. So one of the sort of cardinal rules of thumb is that as long as you're breathing, our perspective is on the people that who come to our stress reduction clinic. As long as you're breathing, we consider that no matter what's wrong with you, no matter what the doctor sent you for, no matter whether it's prostate cancer, breast cancer, heart disease of one kind or another, back pain, as long as you're breathing, no matter what's wrong with you, from our perspective, there's more right with you than wrong with you. Okay? But can we learn to add a pour of some energy into what's already okay with us, which you could call health in the most profound of ways, and see what happens if we were to actually collaborate in our own, you could say, full health, our own interface with the not only the outer world, but also the interior world of our own thoughts, our own emotions, our own sensory experience, in ways that would actually have some degree of balance, some degree of interrelationality, because all the senses are actually interrelational, so that while you're the sensor of the universe, okay, so is everybody else. So is everybody else, the center of the universe. So that means, in a sense, there's no center. Cosmologists know this. Topologists know this. There's no center, and there's no periphery. But we live in a kind of mostly three-dimensional sort of contraction. And so we bang around kind of in a Newtonian billiard ball-like world. And so do our politicians. And if you think you're driven by a certain degree of ambition or selfing, the politicians almost by definition have to do that just to get reelected. And by the time they're reelected, they may have lost track of what they're doing and why they were elected and what the real calling is of the kind of government or the kind of society that we have, and then just become grist for the mill just like anybody else and wind up so stressed. And I've given talks on Capitol Hill and run meditation retreats on, for members of Congress, and it's like, It's mayhem up there, too. Of course, you can read that in the Times every day or anywhere else. But the question is, what if we were to take the name we gave our species seriously and actually train to familiarize ourselves with the full perspective, the full dimensionality of what it means to be really human, of our interior capacities for learning, for learning, growing, healing, and for that matter, transformation across the whole lifespan. We've been finding in our work that that's not only possible, the people that we see in the stress reduction clinic, of course it would be much better if they had in some way or other learned what they learned in the stress reduction clinic 30 or 40 years earlier. And they will say that. I wish I knew this when I was like a young person. They'll say, it doesn't matter. Now is the only time that we're alive. So now is a good time. And the rest is all thinking. So while thinking is really wonderful, there are other elements of our humanity that could be cultivated in a disciplined way. And that's what we do in what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction. This approach that we developed 27 years ago now at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, which involves training regular people like you and me in Buddhist meditative practices without the Buddhism. Or you could say, with the absolute heart of Buddhism, because Buddhism's about non-duality. So in a sense, if you make yourself into a Buddhist, in your mind, I'm not saying you can't be a Buddhist. I mean, there are Buddhists, and they are just like everybody else, you know? But if you think you're a Buddhist, in a sense, you're not a Buddhist. If this is beginning to sound a little bit like Zen, that's why Zen sounds that way. They're trying to point to something that the intellectual capacity that we have can't figure out because it's jumping to another dimensionality. So if you make a separation Buddhist and non-Buddhist, and then you align with the Buddhist, we're over here and we're more relaxed. Or whatever you fill in the blank, whatever you want to say, the Buddhists, they're so loose, you know, and insightful and compassionate. You know, okay, you've created a story. You've created a total caricature. In a sense, you've robbed them of their humanity. And then you've created all these non-Buddhists over here, not quite as hip. Or whatever. So Buddhism is about non-duality. As soon as you make this and that in your mind, you've lost some underlying connectivity, unity. It's not like there's no night and there's no day. Oh yeah, Buddhists, they're not into dualism, so there's no night and there's no day. Of course there's night and day. But if you get attached to one or the other, like I only do night, I don't do day. This is a very famous, and some people do. I mean, there are people in this university in particular, at least when I was here, they never ever saw the light of day. And they gave us the digital revolution. The internet, email, all of it. There's a very famous not fairy tale, it's from the Arthurian tradition, Sir Gawain and the Loathly Lady. I'm not going to tell it to you, but it has to do with night and day and non-attachment. And it also has to do with a koan, which is, in the Zen tradition, a question that the teacher often poses to a student that cannot be answered by the conceptual mind. So this one is, what is it that all women most desire? It first appeared in The Wife of Bathsdale, Geoffrey Chaucer, and now it's in this, what is it that all women most desire? It was posed to King Arthur himself. But you can ask yourself whether you're a man or a woman, and as soon as the mind starts cogitating on it, you're off. I mean, off to the races and also off, like, wrong place. So there's this other capacity that we have called awareness. When was the last time you took a course in awareness? unless you've gone to Buddhist retreat centers. That's what it's about. It's about paying attention. Meditation, my working definition of it, to boil it down, there are all sorts of complexities to this, but to boil it down, it's about paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally. And that's called mindfulness. Paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally. Ultimately, it stops being on purpose. That's called deliberate mindfulness. It's cultivated, just like you'd cultivate, you know, vegetables. But ultimately, it becomes, in a sense, I shouldn't say second nature. The Buddhists would call it your true nature. And it starts to become what you could call effortless mindfulness. You're just here more. When you were in school, they don't do this at MIT, of course, but they take attendance, you know, in elementary school. And what do you say when they call your name? You say, present. But most of the time, you're only like, that should be qualified. I'm present to a degree, but actually my mind is off outside in the tree with the bird or whatever, because a lot of time it's more interesting than what's going up in front of the blackboard, which is a problem for education. But imagine if we had an education that actually cultivated this capacity for awareness alongside this capacity for thinking and brought them into a certain kind of balance that manifested in the interior world in a sense, even just in terms of being embodied. Just embodied. Sometimes, you know, there's no word inheaded, but most of us are inheaded. We're not embodied. There's a wonderful line that I like to quote a lot from James Joyce, one of his short stories in Dubliners. There's a line in there that goes a little bit like this. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. You can live a short distance from your body for 20 or 30 years, and then a heart attack wakes you up and says, aha, there was some... You were getting signals for a number of years. Do you remember those phone calls that you were getting? They weren't coming through Verizon. They were actually coming through your somatosensory system, and you were too busy to pay attention to. Do you remember those? Well, our patients will say, you know, that heart attack that I had that didn't kill me, it was one of the greatest gifts of my life. Why? And they'll say it just this way. It woke me up. That's what the Buddhists talk about. Waking up. Waking up from what? Well, it could be said a lot of different ways, but they would say from ignorance, ignoring certain aspects of the world, inwardly and outwardly, that turned out, we thought, trivial, turned out not to be trivial. Turned out to be important, not to become obsessed with, not to become a narcissist. I am, I'm so in my body. I love this yoga, you know. You can see that I'm a yogi. No, that's all just like Madison Avenue, more pumping up the personal pronouns. I, me, and mine. Yeah. My center of my universe is doing very well, thank you, and includes being embodied, healthy, you know. No, it's about non-attachment to the ways in which we grasp onto concepts that actually keep us at a distance from the actuality of reality, if you want to call it that. Now, I know, that's bring in reality, that brings in an awful lot of conversation. And since this is about conversation, we can certainly visit that in the discussion. But I would like to weave it in another direction and say, okay, if meditation is about paying attention and awareness, and the subject in some ways is the ceaseless society, and you know what this does to your body and your mind and your creativity for that matter, or your capacity for love, I get asked all the time, because when I give medical grand rounds, and mostly I speak to medical audiences, and they'll say, oh, meditation's really about paying attention. Do you think it might have any sort of benefit for people with attention deficit disorder? It's a perfectly valid question. And the answer is, well, there was something that was learnable that you could actually train in to cultivate something, and you could also take a drug and just jump there right away, but the drug had a lot of different other side effects that might not be so healthy. Do you think there'd be any value in actually doing the training? No, too busy. I'll just take the drug, thank you very much. And, you know, people say that about stress reduction at the medical center. You know, all the residents want stress reduction. And your medical residency, even with the new changes, still one of the most stressful jobs on the planet. They want, all want stress reduction. But until recently, it's like, well, do you have it in pill form? Because who's got time to stop or to practice? This is the other thing about meditation. When you get into it, it looks an awful lot like nothing. I mean, it looks so much like nothing that your thinking mind is going to say, this is bullshit. This is nothing. It's just nothing. It's the emperor's new clothes. There's nothing happening here. That was about 15 thoughts that the mind secreted in reaction. Actually, it's not true that there's nothing going on. For one thing, you know, there's a lot that we don't notice. There's sounds. There's scents. S-E-N-T-S. I think that's how you spell it. There's sights. There's this sense of the body sitting or standing and being in some way, not in this room, but caressed by the air. What air? The geniuses here. It happens, you know. Oh, yeah, we forgot about the air. Oh, no, we'll give them plenty of air, but then you can't hear. And I'm not knocking the architecture. I mean, it's just like, you know, this moment is this way from where I'm standing. But when you say nothing, the mind says nothing, there's an architecture to nothing. It's not really nothing. You could say, in a sense, it's everything. So nothing and everything have a very interesting inter-embeddedness. And so does thinking and awareness. They intermingle. They are co-creative. I was in Bonn not long ago doing some teaching, and I was wandering around the, you know, sort of in Bonn. I had a few hours, and I'm passing by across the street from a beautiful yellow building that was obviously a university building. So I went over to the Department of Microbiology and Chemistry. And there's a big statue in front of it. And I thought, who's going to be, you know, the statue? Turns out it's Kekulé. Maybe that doesn't move you at all. But Kekulé is very famous in chemistry. And many scientists know the story of Kekulé. I asked my hosts, who were Buddhists, do you know who that is? And they said, no, it's Kekulé. I said, well, great, you know, never heard of him. But Kekulé was an organic chemist who was trying to discern the structure of benzene. And every time he did the analysis, it came out that the number of hydrogens and the number of carbons was the same. It was like six, and like, how do you do that? And what was required is what's often required in science is a kind of a leap of understanding that doesn't come out of thought. Thinking. After a while, we call it banging your head against the wall. And then the story is he went to sleep one night after doing this for months, and he had a dream. And the dream was, famously, that he dreamed of a snake swallowing its own tail. And that was the beginning of our understanding of atomic orbitals, molecular orbitals. That, oh, okay, the electrons are shared among the entire ring. Why didn't I think of that? Well, that's what we all say whenever somebody has some profound insights. Why didn't I think of that? That's why there's so much competition in science. Why didn't I think of that? Well, we don't know. Creativity is mysterious. But one way to generate or tilt the probability of creativity is to cultivate more spaciousness in the mind. Because thought tends to sort of contract and then get a certain sense. It gets stymied when it can't get the next thought. And sometimes if you learn how to just stand there at what the Zen people in the Zen archery will call the point of highest tension, nobody could string or pull back Odysseus's bow except Odysseus. Nobody. But when you can stand at the point of highest tension, with the thoughts going nowhere, and hold it in something bigger, wakefully, not necessarily in a dream, but actually wakefully, interesting connections seem to appear because they're already here, but we are in some sense blind to them because our thinking itself acts like lenses and prevents us from seeing orthogonal opportunities. Opportunities that are rotated in some way in relationship to the tacit assumptions, to what's already known. And what science is about is going between what's already known and the next thing that's going to be known, but how is it going to happen? And part of that is just an incredibly beautiful adventure. Well, so you could say, in a sense, all scientists are already meditators in a way, but it's important to know it and to actually practice cultivating this, if this, what I'm saying, speaks to you in any way, because it's not a good idea. Mindfulness is not just a good idea. I'll be more mindful, I'll be less stressed. The ceaseless society won't be a problem for me. No, this is something that requires continual dancing with. And really allowing ourselves to not be so caught in what we know that we don't any longer feel comfortable in not knowing. I remember it was sometimes very, very difficult to ask stupid questions here. Very difficult. And I always loved it when someone else had the courage to ask a really dumb question. Usually it turned out to be really important. And it was freeing. So as soon as we can't go into where we don't know, then what's known becomes dead. Because the interface is what's important. So maybe I'll say a few things and wrap up. That'd be all right? One is that an interesting study was done at UCSF a couple of years ago. Maybe I will show it to you. If you, by the way, I was hoping I would tell a lot of stories about MIT, and I learned meditation here at MIT for the first time. You know, you ask people who have been meditating for 30, 40 years, how did you get into meditation? Well, I went to India, or I went to Thailand and sat in a forest refuge or a monastery or whatever. And people ask me, how did you learn meditation? Oh, I was at MIT. I was walking down the halls one day, and I saw a sign. The Three Pillars of Zen. It was in 1966. And it was like the Vietnam War was just beginning to cook. The Gulf of Tonkin incident. I mean, it's like this place was really interesting. And I was alienated out of my mind. And I saw this sign, the Three Pillars of Zen. I didn't know what else to do that afternoon. Nothing was working in the lab. And, you know, I didn't know what Zen was. It was at the invitation of Houston Smith. I'd never heard of Houston Smith. He was a professor of philosophy here and a very august character. And it was a talk given by Philip Kaplow. I'd never heard of Kaplow, who started the Rochester Zen Center, where I'm actually going next weekend to give the keynote for their 40th anniversary celebration. Kaplow died last year. It's like really weird karma. So I go to this talk. Out of all of MIT, there were four people there. I kid you not, that's seminar hour, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I wrote it up in Coming to Our Senses. And I also wrote up my thesis defense in Coming to Our Senses. Because I put something, I was so tired of this place by the time I got through with my thesis, I put on a page all by itself in the thesis, he who dies before he dies does not die when he dies. It was like, yeah, and I'm out of here. And, you know, my thesis defense lasted 3 hours or something like that. An hour and a half was on that line. That's how it started out. You say, John, what is this all about? You know, does he who dies before he does? And, you know, all of my whole thesis, you know, committee were like, you know, members of the National Academy and Nobel laureates. Luria was a Nobel laureate. They took 45, they were all like 10 years at least younger than I am now, and they took at least, you know, an hour on what does this really mean. And they wanted to know. I mean, they were really like, you know, it it tweaked something in them. So anyway, I wrote about all these things, and I had the thought, wow, if I had hours here, there are an awful lot of different threads that I could draw together here that are very much related to like how we live our lives and how it manifests in our work, in our relationships, in our relationship to our body, in our health across the lifespan, and when it comes right down to it, in something even more important. And that would be, dare I use the word here, happiness. In our level of profound well-being that's grounded in self-compassion and compassion for others and the degree of understanding about the human condition and life on this planet, that sort of wisdom and compassion would emerge out of that. I consider that to be not only the human birthright, but that is our inheritance. And if we squander it, it's, you know, there's nobody else to blame. It's just a plain Bush. You know, if you want. But, you know, in a sense, we're creating him and everybody else. This is like a co-creative universe. So, this was the cover of Time magazine before many of you were born, but they do this every 6 months. They do this every 6 months. Stress is not going away. Okay? And those of you who are in the Buddhist tradition or understand something about Dharma, the word dukkha is very often translated as stress. Dukkha is the kind of first noble truth, is the actuality of the human condition in regard to dissatisfaction and the fact that we suffer. The fact that we suffer. And there's nothing gloomy or nihilistic or pessimistic about it. It's an observation. And what the Buddha was interested in is it possible to hold the suffering in a way that is liberating? And his answer was yes. And I think of it more like a research scientist than like a spiritual figure in some ways, who had very, very no instruments other than his own mind and body to investigate the nature of mind and body and suffering. And he calibrated those instruments in a way that most of us never do, and then use them to look. So this is the study I want to show you by Alyssa Epple and her colleagues in Blackburn's laboratory. They've been studying telomeres, which are the repeat units on the ends of all of our chromosomes. Telomeres. They're repeat units of, you know, strings of A's and G's and T's. And it turns out that when eukaryotic cells divide, the telomeres get shorter. Every time the cells divide, the telomeres get shorter. And telomere shortening has a certain kind of rate. And that rate, this study shows, is dependent on stress. That the rate of telomere shortening, which is dramatically associated to aging, is actually related to the levels of chronic stress we're under and chronicity. So that means, have you ever heard the words come out of your mouth, God, this is taking years off my life? It's true. So when we're talking about time in the ceaseless society, I mean, there are all sorts of very interesting paradoxes about time. Have you ever had the words come out of your mouth, I don't have any time for this? Or I don't have any time. I'm out of time. Well, you know, we start to believe our own PR, and after a while we live that way. Like, I'm sorry, I'm just too busy, I don't have any time. Well, we may not have any time to be alive, to be awake, to be in touch. We're so busy getting someplace else, so caught up in the future, worrying about what hasn't happened, or obsessing about what's already over. Present moment can very easily get squeezed. Now, the interesting thing about this study is, so chronicity of caregivers, these are parents, excuse me, parents of children who are... have chronic illness. So you can't just like say, I think I'll reduce my stress, abandon my children, and just you know, forget about it. It's like, no, that's not part of the invitation here. Now, the interesting thing is they also looked at parents who didn't have children who had chronic illnesses, but they asked them their level of perceived stress. In other words, how much stress are you under in your life? And the interesting thing is that this relationship of that the relationship of more increase in the rate of telomere shortening, well, my lasers don't want to work on this, is not only related to the actual stress, but is related to perceived stress. That's very, very important. Because while you can't change the actual stress that you're under in many cases, how you relate to it, you can change enormously. How you relate to it can change enormously. How you relate to it means, how am I going to be in relationship to the actuality of my moments as they unfold, moment by moment, the good ones, the bad ones, and the ugly ones. What Zorba the Greek called the full catastrophe. And that is unbelievably promising, and they are now doing, this is hot stuff in the, you know, this particular field, they're now doing a lot of research to look more deeply into this sort of acceleration of the aging process with stress. That stress can be thought-based. I mean, it can be just as stressful to think that you're in trouble as to be in real trouble. The body doesn't really know the difference. When the brain gets going, it's so creative, it can create any reality it wants, including, I'm living in a nightmare. Well, be careful what you tell yourself, because if you believe it, it may not be true, even if it's very painful. If there's a way to be in wise and compassionate relationship with your pain, with your fear, with all of what the Dalai Lama calls your afflictive emotions, there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with anger. There's nothing wrong with sadness. There's nothing even wrong with jealousy. When you get caught is when you're in trouble. If you notice an impulse of envy and you see what it is, it's like touching it with a soap bubble with your finger. It goes poof. And it arose and it passed away. And it's impermanent. It doesn't grab you. But when you attach to something, I want this and I don't want that, that is the root in some sense of suffering. And these are the kinds of things that we work with in the stress reduction clinic. We do not call ourselves human doings. I was suggesting earlier that what we're really talking about is not nothing, but non-doing. You could call it being. Okay. Now, if doing is associated with thought, let's just give me that for a second. Doing and thinking, they kind of go together. Okay. What would being go with? Being would go with awarenessing, okay? It would go with this other quality of mind and heart that we have that we don't ever refine, cultivate. There's no place to do it in school or anything else. You'd have to discover yoga or meditation or Buddhism or it's in all the traditions. But it has to do with a cultivation of aspects of our being that are not part of our curriculum. This is making its way into the mainstream big time. This is one of our professional training programs for 150 physicians and other health professionals. And we spend a huge amount of time doing what looks from the outside like nothing. But it's not doing, it's being. And I don't want to leave you with the impression that it's entirely wonderful experience. It's the hardest work in the world. And it's entirely wonderful to have any experience whatsoever and be in touch with it. And when you start to practice being in relationship to the experience that you're having, as opposed to the experience that your mind says you want to be having, you have the potential to reclaim your life, your body, your heart, your world in ways that are, in some sense, unimaginable. And therefore, maybe we should begin to imagine them. MBSR, this mindfulness-based stress reduction, is now spread across the country and around the world. This is an old map. And it's being funded to the tune of tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to do research in mindfulness-based stress reduction, in these meditative practices and their relationships to the mind, the body, to health, and so forth. And this is a poster for the last public meeting between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. The first one happened at MIT. The last one happened in Washington, D.C., back in November. I'm going to stop at this point and just leave you with a line from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. If you haven't read T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets recently or ever, I suggest you go back and read it. Now, let me make two recommendations in terms of scientific reading. One is Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. If you haven't read it in the past 5 years, go back and read it again. Hermann Hesse got something. He understood something. And it's under 100 pages. It's one of the most beautiful works of art, but it's the art of the heart and the mind. And the other is T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. So two little things. One is, and he plays on this because it's quartets, it's musical themes. He's using words as music, as sounds, as notes. And at one point he says, quick, now, here, now, always. Quick, now, here, now, always. Ridiculous, the waste, sad time, stretching before and after. And then at the end, in the last stanza, he says, quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. Put that in parenthesis, by the way. That stanza starts with, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. This knowing that MIT is all about, that science is all about, that art is all about, it's boundless. It's got no center, no periphery, but it is knowable. And if we don't cultivate those aspects of our being that can be in what you might call wise relationship to, whether you want to call it the ceaseless society or the ceaseless mind that never shuts down, you don't have to travel far to find the ceaseless mind. And it will happen, as was pointed out. That's been the case all throughout history. If we can learn to be in right relationship to it, in some sense, that is the path of well-being, happiness, and for the body politic, too, not just for us as individuals. If we can't, the shadow side of being human is not going to magically go away, no matter how wonderful our technology gets. You may have noticed a lot of it's devoted to better ways to kill ourselves and each other. So I will, at this point, stop and just thank you for your attention. I realize that, you've got better things to do with your day than come to something like this. You know, as they say in car talk, you know, well, now you've wasted another perfectly good hour listening to click and clack. So I want to just thank you for your attention and to say that if any of this touches you in even the slightest of ways, there are many, many, many resources beyond even T.S. Eliot and Siddhartha that might tickle whatever nerves have been touched in this room, and it becomes literally the adventure of a lifetime. And I want to thank you just for coming and listening.
Now I understand why the Dalai Lama resorted to visors. About 2 weeks ago, I was teaching in Colorado, and it was one of those 2 days in a month when I look at the newspaper. Those are the days of my confessions. And I quickly turned to the most pertinent page on the newspaper, the cartoon section. And there was this cartoon situated in the 1800s. Where these two guys were talking to each other, and one was saying, you know, I've been hearing rumors that in the future there are these things called computers, and it always keeps human beings busy. So rest as much as you can now. Well, thank you very much, John, for that wonderful talk. And this whole idea of ceaseless society, or cultivating at least a mind that ceases at certain times is a sort of a very important focus in any kind of contemplative tradition. It's just, I think, due to the corporate nature of this world that Buddhists are trying to monopolize it to some degree. One of my hopes while being at MIT is that once I'll get this big endowment and then I'll start a department of screenplay writing. Because you see, when you look at your mind, you know, all of you are wonderful authors. A thought arises, another thought arises, another thought arises. And after five thoughts, you will realize that there's no correlation between the first thought that arose and the fifth thought. You see? But it's a wonderful cycle of how these thoughts arise. And then, with these thoughts, also arises certain kinds of emotions. For example, you think of a person, then things arise like likeness or dislikeness about this person. And then your mind gives this running background commentary on the sense of likeness and dislikeness. And next thing you know, an hour has passed just being in your mind. And another wonderful story, but not of much use, that has come out. So my hope is that once we start this department at MIT, we will be able to tap into these thoughts and create wonderful screenplay and you know, make it sort of nice Hollywood productions. But that is the sort of the purpose of our gathering today, is how to cultivate a mind that learns as a cultivation, that learns to pay attention to the present moment, to live in this moment. You see, most often when you look at the mind, it is either dwelling in experiences of the past, incidents that has already happened, so it's reminiscing, and feeling sort of the aftermath of those experiences. And these experiences could have happened 10 years ago. But the mind, this dwelling mind, is still dwelling. And if it was a joyous experience, or what you characterize as a happy experience, then this dwelling mind dwells in there and tries to recreate that experience, tries to at least recreate that kind of feeling. Not always successful. And then you have this mind that is always anxious about the future. See, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen in 5 minutes, 5 hours, 5 days, 5 years, retirement? But, of course, you don't want to think after that. For example, the great full stop. So mind conveniently thinks of things that you want to think about. See, but it is never actually at the present moment. It's either in the past or in the present?
Future.
Oh, yes. I think I'm a little bit in the present. So that is sort of the function of cultivation, is when we talk about paying attention, meaning how to live in every moment, how to live in every moment. The reason being, I mean, yes, again, we can, you know, we have this tendency of what the Buddha called, you see, that we like to project things. Of course, all the good things, as John said, we are the center of the universe, so we have it. But all the bad things, it's in the other person. Or it's in the group of people. So we like these projections. And part of the trouble with these projections is that we are never able to sort of look back and see, where are these problems really? Whether are they really outside of me, or whether they are inside me, and moreover, whether they are inside my mind? And how do I sort of pay attention to it in a systematic way? And then try to eliminate these problems. Because problems of the mind also can be eliminated like other problems. But it's simply an issue of whether we focus. So, we'll go into more conversations, but I just wanted to emphasize this by narrating to you a story about the Zen master Ikkyu. Ikkyu had this wonderful disciple who traveled for years and months, you know, searching different Zen masters. And then after 6 months of travel, he arrives at Ikkyu's monastery. And he comes to Ikkyu and he gives this long preface that, you know, I have traveled so much, have searched for truth here and there, and people say that you are the most brilliant of Zen masters. Can you give some profound teaching? And Ikkyu picks up his brush and writes a character in Japanese, which meant attention. Of course, this visitor is disappointed. He said, you know, I traveled for 6 months and all you can offer me is this one word, attention. Can't you say something more profound? Ikkyu writes again. attention. Now, this visitor is a bit frustrated, and he goes again, "Well, really, you know, I don't have much long to live, and I've really traveled a lot. Can't you give me some more profound teachings?" And EQ writes, "Attention means attention." So we'll do some question and answers, and hopefully most of the questions will be directed towards John.
So there is a mic up there, on the, all the way at the top. If you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand so that I can kind of see you, and the mic will come down to you. Okay, why don't we start right up there? Yes.
I was wondering, I've been doing research in similar things, I guess. Is there any taxonomy in terms of what's positive psychology, what's flow, what's mindfulness? This seems like, I mean, Harvard is now running a class, which is, I think, the most popular class on campus. But has right. anyone made an effort to sort of unify the disparate efforts in this area to avoid duplication?
I'm not sure duplication is necessarily a bad thing, and it wouldn't be duplication anyway, because there's a huge kind of natural diversity to this. And so if you think of it as kind of a stage in the evolution of society, that maybe this fecundity is really valuable. You're right that there is somebody at Harvard teaching George Wald's old Natsai 5 course and bringing meditation into it. And you know, apparently it's the most popular course in the school. That would certainly be the case if this were happening at MIT too. And the reason for it is that it relates the outer to the inner in a way that I think, in a sense, we're starving for it, and we also pay a very high price for it. So potentially, education is moving in a direction that will actually systematically develop how to cultivate awareness on the one hand and everything that goes along with it. That's an umbrella term for a huge epistemology, many epistemologies, and thought on the other end. Where emotion fits in and all of this. I mean, and what I didn't get to in my presentation was some of the actual brain studies that we've been doing and immune studies looking at how emotion regulation changes in the brain as a function of training and mindfulness-based stress reduction and so forth. So there is a scientific literature that's beginning to develop, and as you put it, a taxonomy. But I would say that really this whole field is virtually in its infancy. And so there's a certain richness and sorting out now that you wouldn't want to collapse into some kind of overriding one unity too soon, but let it just foment like that.
Next question. How does what
you... Here, you'll get the microphone, then other people can... hear better.
How does what you've been talking about relate to disease?
To disease?
To disease.
That's a really profound question. And in coming to our senses, I actually deal with that question in multiple ways, one of which is to split the very word disease into dis-ease. And there is a there are a number of schools of thought that recognize that disease is the end point of a long concatenation of different kinds of dysregulatory phenomena in the mind-body, so to speak, because they influence each other. And Gary Schwartz, a long time ago when he was at Harvard, actually talked about disattention leads to disconnection. Like not paying attention to the body, and the first thing you know is like you have a heart attack, but that's because you weren't paying attention. That's like, you know, if someone says, well, you know, my wife left me, and well, were there any early warning signs? No, she just left. It's very unbelievable that your first symptom is your last. It sometimes happens with sudden cardiac death, but even there, it may have to do with non-awareness of, you know, emotional reactivity.
So disattention leads to disconnection, leads to dysregulation, leads to dis-ease. Okay? There may be another step in there, but there's a concatenation of things, and it works quite nicely. On the other hand, if you flip it, attention would lead to connection, to the recognition of connection, to the non-disruption of interconnections and regulation, therefore to ease, so to speak, or what you call health. So this has profound implications in relationship to disease, both in terms of the etiology of many of our chronic stress-related disorders, and also in terms of reversing that flow from training the mind actually has profound influences on the body. We did one study with people with psoriasis, the skin disease, which is not a cancer, but it is an uncontrolled cell proliferation in the epidermis. And it's very labile to emotional stress. And there's no cure for it. And the biology is not fully understood, but it has a lot to do with growth factors and apoptotic factors and so forth. And what we did was show that people who are receiving ultraviolet light treatments for psoriasis, when you're out in sunlight, your skin actually, the psoriasis will go away. So we have the genetic potential for the skin to be in two different conditions. The people who were meditating while they were receiving the ultraviolet light treatments healed at four times the rate of the people who were just getting the ultraviolet light by itself. That was so amazing to me. I replicated the study and got the same result before I published it. But there are ways in which the mind can actually influence the body. And again, the science of this is in its absolute infancy. But whether it's emotional regulation or immune function, and we've showed that, you know, the meditation practice can enhance the response to a flu vaccine, for instance, antibody response to a flu vaccine. These things need a great deal more study, but now, at least happily, there's funding for this kind of research. So thank you for that question.
Following up on that question, where does mental...
Wave your hand, so... Okay, gotcha.
Where does mental illness fit into the picture? If you have a mind that is out of control, how do you meditate? I've never heard anyone address that issue as far as meditation is concerned.
Well, mental illness is a very, very big umbrella. So there are, you know, sort of gradations and spectra of all sorts of different kinds of diagnostic problems. I'm not suggesting that meditation is the answer to all life's problems, including, you know, severe mental illness. But there are many interesting studies now being done where people are actually trying to teach people with various mental disorders to meditate, to cultivate body awareness, for instance, or to be more in the present moment, to learn self-calming strategies, all sorts of things. And so the jury is still out on where this might be of use and where not. In terms of things like depression and anxiety disorders, which are basically under that umbrella, but the prevalence of depression and anxiety in our society, lifetime and at any one moment, is huge. It's already being shown, and we've done studies, and many other people around the world are doing studies, that show that meditative programs can actually influence how you are in relationship to depressive rumination or to your anxious thoughts and so forth. And you can go from being, in some sense, caught or needing to have, you know, lifetime medication to be able to live, to freeing yourself from some of that through these self-regulatory practices. So it's a wide open field, but I don't want anybody to walk away thinking that I or anybody else, think that meditation is like the answer to all life's problems. It's just one more piece in a very large puzzle, but it's a very, very important piece because it has a dimensionality that usually not present in various kinds of either psychotherapies or physical clinical practice. And there are movements in physical clinical medicine to actually bring greater mindfulness in part because, and we've all had the experience, doctors are under so much stress that, in a sense, they don't have enough time to be with you and get what they think they need to get done, done. So they'll sacrifice the being with you, and you feel disregarded, and that is an awful feeling and is iatrogenic in its own right. And so we have to actually begin to train the medical students in ways to be present, even though the impulse is to cut and run. And we're doing that.
I joined the MIT faculty in 76 and was lucky enough to know Salvador Luria, who also used to ask me why I was doing things, so I shared that experience. I was struck by many of the things that you said. They seemed to resonate with me, but I guess a thought I had as you were talking was there are certainly some things that have identified with periods of quiet, but there also seem to be many of the things you said which I sort of feel I experience almost sort of in the midst of an ongoing day. And I wondered if you would comment on sort of the relationship of some of those moments, sort of without setting it aside as a period of meditation, and how that relates to how this might go.
Well, that's,
I'm not trying to argue for not stopping, but I did think it.
Yeah, but maybe part of your mind says, well, but maybe there's a way to keep doing and still be.
Well, I think something, you know, for example, the creativity doesn't usually ever come to me when I'm sitting quietly somewhere. It just suddenly erupts in the middle of something else, and that was partly what triggered this question.
Well, that's great, and another impression I do not want to leave you with is that meditation is only about stillness. Okay, stillness is folded into movement, and movement is folded into stillness. And someone asked about flow and mentioned the word flow. And all of these things are deeply connected. And if you read the Four Quartets, it's all about stillness inside the motion and motion inside the stillness, the still point of the turning world, T.S. Eliot called it. So really, the real meditation practice is your life. Okay? It's not pretending you're a statue in the British Museum or the Museum of Fine Arts. It's not. This is important. There are many different ways to do it. You can do the formal meditation practice lying down, standing, sitting cross-legged on the floor, standing on your head, hanging from your toes. I mean, you can do it in many different ways, but it's all about cultivating certain qualities of heart and mind. The word for heart and the word for mind are the same word in all Asian languages. So that's another thing. When I use the word mindfulness, I also mean heartfulness. So can you be in the present moment wholeheartedly with whatever you're doing? A lot of people say use running to tune out. But what if you use running as your meditation to tune in? All world-class athletes, they tune in. They are with every footfall, proprioception, which is another sense. They are totally with that. Dancers, musicians, so there are thousands of ways to cultivate mindfulness. From slicing vegetables, to cooking dinner, to making love, to saying goodbye to your children, I mean, or waking them up in the morning, there are ways to do it that are mindless, where you're already out the door, and there are ways to do it that honor the preciousness of those moments. And don't get caught in the thought that says, well, I'll have tomorrow, because you don't know. So, again, I'll say it again, just so that it's quite clear. The real meditation practice is none other than your life. It's not some kind of dime store caricature of what we think of as meditation. But the dime store caricatures aside, the formal practice of meditation is extremely important. And the more you don't like it, the more you have resistance for any of this, that's where to put the energy. That's where to start investigating. Who is it that doesn't like this? Why is it that I don't like this? Why do I have an aversion against attention in some areas and no aversion to it, maybe even an addiction to it in another? Well, then you begin to sort of begin to ask deep, penetrative questions and look where you're pointing to yourself
And that's when other dimensions of our being and other dimensions of connectivity, and what is creativity if not connecting this and that and all of a sudden seeing a relationship no one saw before, but it was there before. Okay? Even if it's a painting, a formless painting, an abstract painting. So this is an ongoing process that no two people will ever practice the same. So it's not like you should practice Tenzin's meditation or my meditation. You have to, in some sense, find out, what is my meditation? What is my karmic assignment on this planet? Who am I? These are all deep meditative questions. And the thinking mind is not just ill-prepared to answer those questions, it's incapable of answering those questions. And that's very humbling. But other aspects of the mind, not at all. Thank you.
John, can I actually ask you to say a little more on this, that there is this popular misconception regarding meditation, that it is only relaxation or it is mindfulness. If you could speak on more on the alertness and say the practice of developing insights.
I say in coming to our senses that meditation is not relaxation spelled differently. So a lot of people think, yes,
my microphone and be totally free and I won't have any need for it anymore and I'll just go into nirvana.
And everything will fall away. It's not that that might not happen, but if you attach to that, it's the non-attachment that's important. So now, like, I'm a great meditator. Uh-huh. Except for the personal pronoun, it might be true. So... with relaxation, for instance, you say, oh, that was so relaxing. That was the greatest exercise. I felt so good at the end. It really works. With meditation, you can't say that because it's like, what is a good meditation? Oh, it was such a good meditation. I didn't have any thoughts. Or it was a terrible meditation. My mind was plagued by thoughts. From our perspective, these are the same. The important thing is the awareness thing. The awareness thing. No thoughts? Thoughts? Now, a lot of the time, you think, oh, well, the idea of meditation is to make your mind blank. You know, just shut off your thinking. Shutting off your thinking is just going to give you a headache. If you try to shut off your thinking, it's like trying to make the ocean, Atlantic Ocean, stop waving. It's in the nature of the mind to wave. So if you're forcing anything in any way, no. It's about awareness, pure and simple. The verb that's often used is, speaking of the ceaseless society, can I rest in awareness? Can I rest in awareness? For most of us, that's like strange juxtaposition of words and concepts. But keep it in mind as a question. Is it possible for me to rest in awareness in this moment without having to have anything be different from how it already is in this moment? Then that creates the conditions for seeing beneath the surface of appearances. That's what insight is. It's seeing beneath the surface of the world of appearance, and very often we are so caught in the world of appearances, we have so many stories about my relationship to experience and to my relationship to appearance and my relationship to whatever, and no awareness that we're running down an interesting story that's preventing us from actually being here. We're in our head, we're in our story. There's nothing wrong with that. We all do it a million times a day. That's how the mind waves. It's how the mind works. But the awareness, and we're doing studies, I didn't show you the slides, with Tibetan monks who've been practicing meditation for 30, 40, 50 years. And it's like, you know, if you put Lance Armstrong I have Albert Einstein on a bicycle. I'm sure many of you have seen it, famous. And then I have a picture of Lance Armstrong on a bicycle. It's the same concept, okay, but Lance Armstrong's relationship to his bicycle is different from Einstein's relationship to his bicycle, but one's not better than the other. Would you rather be Lance Armstrong or Einstein? Well, you don't have a choice. You only get to be yourself, okay? So you're not Lance Armstrong and you're not
Einstein. Humiliating, isn't it? Or humbling. But you do get this chance on the planet to be you, and then to be in relationship to the bicycle. Well, the meditation practice is the same way. It's like, you know, some of us have been meditating and we get a certain kind of something from it. Other people, you know, use it in a different way. It's the same practice, but how liberating, how insight comes from it, how the heart opens has to do more than anything with passion, with the degree to which you're willing to live this way instead of now making the story. Besides, all the other story, things about me, I bet you didn't know. I'm meditating now. Really great. Great stuff. You should do it. It'd be really good for you. You're like, look like a nervous wreck to me. Why don't you start meditating? Pretty soon you're advertising meditation. You got no time to do it anymore. You're too busy on the lecture circuit, you know. It's an occupational hazard.
That is. I agree.
Some of what you said about the being at the...
Wave your hand.
Right up here.
Hi. Okay.
Being at the... Putting yourself at the center, sort of making yourself the center of the universe, yeah. Reminds me of the environmental writer Bill McKibben. And he did this experiment where he watched television for... he watched everything that was on one cable station for an entire day. And what he took out of that was that the images, the messages that are coming out of the commercials and all of the TV shows is that you, the viewer, is the center of the universe.
Yeah.
And I would be interested to know, I'd like to hear what you have to say about the overconsumption of the society and how what you're doing, how it relates to environmental work and also sort of just media images and that kind of thing.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I really appreciate it. And I'm only going to answer it very partially because I don't want to sort of impose another sort of nuanced response to, you know, you've been sitting there for a very long time. I do write about this at great length in Coming to Our Senses. Let me just sort of in the global way say that, the people who put stuff on television, they know an awful lot about the human mind and about entraining the human mind. And it doesn't have to do with just the message that you're the center of the universe or that you are really important. But it's really important for you to actually buy this product rather than that product and identify yourself as one of those people that drives my product or brushes his teeth with my product or whatever. And there's a huge degree of conditioning associated with that. It's almost like Pavlovian conditioning. And we all are salivating, on and on, very much caught in conditioning. And what this practice is all about, ultimately, is liberation from habits and conditioning of the mind so that we discover that it's possible to be happy, as the Buddhists would say, independent of causes and conditions. Now, this is one of the reasons why this is no joke. This is not just dime store relaxation. This is the hardest work in the world. It's the work of being human. And you could say, and I do, that from the global, you know, planetary ecosystems perspective, the human species is autoimmune disease of the planet. It's both the disease vector and the ultimate victim of its own ignorance, of its own delusion, of its own lack of awareness. And we're taking down a lot of other species with us and a lot of future generations with us, potentially, if we don't wake up. And there are all sorts of signs, you know, that planetary scientists and, you know, argue about and write about all the time. So mindfulness being about attention is, in some way, it's universal. It doesn't have to do with religion, philosophy. It's not just a good idea. It's pointing to something universal in the human heart, in the human sort of organism, so to speak, that is in its infancy, but it's here. It's the kind of H2O of ice, water, liquid water, and gas. It's like the true nature of our being, independent of the phase changes that happen with changing conditions. And if we learn how to actually recognize our true nature, our whole society and our relationship to consumption would be extraordinarily different. Actually, consumption, just to close with that, is actually another word for tuberculosis. And you know, there's a real relationship there. I mean, to a disease state, because we're continually consuming in endless hunger without awareness of whether it completes us in any way or shape or form.
Just to add a little bit onto that, one of the concepts in environmental economics, economists who are trying to wrap their heads around valuing the environment have come up with this idea of something in the environment having a non-use value. In other words, it's useful to us because we are not using it. So it seems to me that this fits very well with what we're talking about, that if we can really understand our own non-use value, that we can just stop and be ourselves, it entrains us to really appreciating the non-use values of the things that are around us as well. So we have time for about two more questions. We'll take this gentleman right here and right down here. The mic's...
Wave your hand so we can see where the inappropriateness is coming from.
You present a story that is very appealing, and it says, hey, I want to learn more about that. I wonder why you spend so much effort trying to prove scientifically that this is good for you. Because that thought dawned on me when I saw some graphs that looked like buckshot through which you put a straight line and said, see, right. That proves it. And so I just wondered if you'd explain a little bit.
Well, first of all, I want to applaud you for asking that question in that particular way. First of all, to just also say those weren't my graphs, although they could have been, you know. And it shows that, in a sense, science is its own religion, and a lot of things are taken on faith. And when you don't want to hear a scientific talk on how those graphs came to be, that's what you get. Now, why do it at all, or why should I talk about something like that? And I think that there's a way in which the coming together of the Western scientific tradition and Eastern contemplative practices and cross-talk among them, an investigation of the mind from these different perspectives in a collaborative way, can actually, I think, profoundly move culturally and socially and ultimately politically, as well as scientifically, our species, if you will, or our culture as a planet, in a direction of greater wholesomeness and well-being and beneficence, as opposed to greater ignorance and potential violence and mayhem. And so we're using everything at our disposal to do that. And if people will credit meditation, I mean, if I had just set up the stress reduction clinic 27 years ago at UMass and not studied it at all, do you think that the NIH would actually be spending hundreds of millions of dollars to study it now? It's because it was done in the language of science, in the language of medicine, that there's some kind of credibility, and I'm not saying just from myself, but from a whole range of colleagues in different institutions who are generating a field that has elements of validity, but then you don't want to reify that from science into scientism in the same way as you wouldn't want to do that in any other discipline of science. But in the domain that it has validity, it can be profoundly useful in many different ways, both politically and socially as well as scientifically, to enrich our understanding of what might be possible.
If I can comment on that, you see, my undergraduate work was in physics, and I remember the last day of the final semester during this college application process. I went to my advisor, and he asked me what I wanted to study further, and I said I was going into the field of theoretical physics. And he looked at me very sadly and said, well, as your advisor, I must confess, there's not much market for theoretical physics. And that was true. You know, if you study theoretical physics, you will either end up teaching in a university go to a research lab, or you'll end up in Wall Street. And Wall Street was the best of choices because, of course, the six-figure salary. But then I looked at him and I said, you see, since I'm a monk already and religion has been a stable market, I will go back to being a monk. But John is right in terms of science being the new sort of dominant religion. You see, if I go to an audience and say, you know, meditation is good for you. I mean, look at your own mind. It's in a state of half a mess or complete mess, you see? And meditation is telling you how to get out of it. People seldom pay attention unless they are looking at their own mind. But if I preface the sentence and say, scientists say that meditation is good for you, they have no clue what research or data I'm talking about. But because I preface the word with science or scientist, it goes immediately and says, oh, meditation must be good for me. So that's sort of the psychological effect on people.
Hi, I've been teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction, and using the image of the mandala, the center of the circle and the sides of it are never separate. And that way what we have going on inside is never separate from what's going on in the world around us. I'm so glad you make that explicit in coming to our senses. I teach meditation at Wellesley College. In my experience, higher education tends to be very Cartesian. And I wonder if there were more opportunities for this connected knowing of bringing the inner life and the outer life together, wouldn't that be potentially transformative in the way that people receive their education?
I think you know the answer to that. And you spoke it and stated it very beautifully. And so in a sense, we're at a very interesting, what I call a branch point as a culture, where mindfulness made its way into the mainstream through medicine. Okay, but now it's moving into law, it's moving into sports, it's moving into education, it's moving into a lot of different domains. And so if, in fact, it did restore some element to education that has been denatured in a certain way by being too obsessed with some brilliant, creative, in some sense precocious aspects of the human brain and mind, but at the expense of other aspects that have been withering in a certain way, yeah, you're not kidding that that would breathe a life back into the education that would look a lot like Nalanda University or universities when they first, you know, came into Western civilization, and they all came out of an interface between the contemplative and the sacred and the secular in the Renaissance. And so, like, maybe what we are sitting on top of is a tipping point that could tip us if we participate in the tipping, because otherwise it could tip very much in a way we don't want it to go, into a Renaissance that would make the European-Italian Renaissance look like kids' play by comparison, because of the scientific and communications capacities that we have now. If we could actually tap into these elements of our own being and understand the beauty of the interconnectedness of the outer and the inner in the mandala that you're speaking of, which is ultimately just the mandala of the human heart, I think what education is really meant to do, it would do a lot more effectively, and it would give rise to different kinds of work in our society that might be incredibly beneficial to the health of the planet, the health of the nation, the health of all of us. Now, that's a big, you know, that's a big thing to talk about Renaissance like that. But why the hell not? What do we have to lose?
Once again, I'd like to encourage you to please do join us at the reception just upstairs while we continue the conversation. Thanks again to both of our speakers.
Thank you so much.